Hi, this is Glenn Mulcahy, your host for Love of the Game Summits podcast and now our live stream series. And I'm really excited to be able to connecting with Chris Beach, who I'll give a brief introduction on, and we're going to do it, have what I think is going to be an amazing chat. So Chris grew up loving athletics and fell in love with ice hockey, where he was drafted 7th overall by the Washington Capitals in 1999. Which also happens to be the birth year of my son. So he's a 99 or an 87 or whatever the case may be. He went on to play 15 years of professional hockey. Journey included a mix of success and adversity, and as well came to recognize the importance of support network, friends, family, and professionals to make the changes along his journey to perform the best that he could. After he hung up his skates after 15 seasons, he went on to do a master's in sports management and is now seeing the results of his thesis come to fruition through the eMobility platform that he envisioned many years ago and is literally going live as we speak. And we'll do a deep dive on that platform. Chris, I can't thank you enough for making time for this. I'm glad we were able to fit this in and looking forward to our chat. So first question I ask, and I've been doing this for years, tell us where you grew up and what did you play as a kid?
I grew up in Sicamous, BC, in the interior of British Columbia, from Vancouver. If you drive 5 hours, 500 and I think it's about 502 kilometers on Highway 1 through the Coquihalla, you'll hit Sicamous, and it's about 510 west from Calgary. So it's right in the middle on Highway 1. For those of you who know Shuswap Lake, and then you probably know in Western Canada, grew up right there. And small town, 3,000 people. And we had baseball and hockey, essentially, as our sports coming up. And fastball, softball, big softball spot as well with the DeWitts there. So, small town, known as the houseboat capital of the world for many years through the 80s and 90s, got relegated to houseboat capital of Canada late 90s, unfortunately, with the real estate boom heading into the early 2000s. But a small town, hockey and baseball, lots of great players came out of Sicamous in the 80s, the Flockhart brothers. Came out, Ron and Rob. Rob unfortunately passed away recently, so he was a loss to our community there. Mm-hmm. And then, throughout the 90s, late 90s and 2000s, we saw a huge influx of players come out of Sicamous. Myself, Shea Weber, Cody France, and Adrian Wiedemann played in the AHL and Europe. Andrew Kozak, AHL, Europe, all these players literally lived within a 2-block radius of my house. And I used to see Shea as we walked to school almost every day. So a hockey town, a lot of great parents that gave to the game, a lot of knowledge there. And that's where I learned, the love and passion for the game of hockey in Sicamous, BC. And it was driven by people like my dad and Shay's dad and many other really passionate parents there.
So how long did you play baseball in addition to hockey, or was it hockey, hockey, hockey? Because God forbid you say that, because I'm like, please share. There's the benefit to playing other sports.
Yeah, I played baseball until I was about 15. So if you look at the literature, I did it appropriately. So I specialized. Yeah, I didn't know it at the time. But when I studied a master's in sports management, I realized that I did it appropriately. So I swam as well. I figure skated till I was 13. I swam. I wasn't a great swimmer. I couldn't master the breathing. So that's one competitive sport that I eventually, my mom, I was getting such anxiety about the breathing. I remember just quitting. I'd do like a 50 or 100 meter race and I would just get to one end. I just like, I can't breathe. So one competitive sport that I actually ended up quitting. But yeah, I was I did BMX racing up until I was about 12. All sorts of sports. I skateboarded a lot. Tennis. I played tennis. I didn't play organized tennis, but my brother was 6 years older than me, and we used to go hammer the ball back and forth for hours. So yeah, lots of different sports, but baseball. Played up till I was 15. I finally got to a AAA level. I went to play on a team in Vernon, and I used to pitch a lot, and I realized pretty quickly that I wasn't a pitcher. So I stuck to, I got dingers hit off me quite often. So I stuck to catching, and I actually caught for a kid who went on to play minor league ball, and played for the Canadian national team. We played everything we possibly could, and that was the environment in my house. It was anything we did. Ping pong was a battle. Anything we did, we tried to master and perfect skills in that game, except for swimming. Swimming was the only one.
No, you share the same on that one. The way I learned how to swim is my dad threw me off a dock. Said, go swim.
Yeah. And my brother was quite good, actually. My brother was one of the best in the province in swimming. So that was his thing. He's a good hockey player, too.
So that's our generation, right? As we kind of all grew up, especially smaller towns. I wasn't a small town. I was all urban. But I played a lot of organized and a lot of unorganized. The free play, like you're giving examples on the tennis. I did the racquetball, the golf, and the skiing. Wasn't organized, wasn't competitive, but man, I loved it. So then you've shifted. So 15 is when you hung up the cleats, and then you started focusing on hockey. So tell us about your path in the hockey world. And then where I'm really curious is what your take was, what your perception when you got drafted on that special day, 7th overall.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I got drafted in the Bantam draft. At 14, so I was 3rd overall in Western Hockey Bantam draft, and I'm not a I personally think the Bantam draft in Western Canada should move up a year. I'm not a huge believer in drafting kids that young, but
thank you. I've been told why it's so early, because I know a lot of scouts for WHL scouts.
Yeah,
because they have such a big territory to cover, they need an extra year to do their scouting. And I was like, really? And he goes, yeah, we have such big territories to go, like all over the province. We got to drive around. But I'm like, 14 is the kids are still so young.
Yeah,
I mean, you're now coaching like U15, so you're coaching 14-year-olds, and they're still developing, and they continue to develop into their adulthood, right? So yeah. I totally agree with you. I think it's way too early. I think they should align with all the rest of the – because the OHL and Q, they're at 15. So, and I'll never forget how crazy it was when my son was at that year and a second year with all – because he was at an AAA team. And all the parents were like, oh, we got to make sure he gets drafted. And I'm like, really? He's 14. Like, there's still got more ways to go. So thanks for that.
Yeah, it's a big jump from Bantam to midget. So if you have, and saying that, in my year, there's a lot of players that ended up playing, going on to play and have good pro careers. But there was some other players that barely played Western Hockey League in the first round. So in my perspective, that extra year getting into midget, give you another year of growth and see where the kids are at. I think from the WHL team's perspective as well, you might have a guy that's bigger and stronger, but all of a sudden a year of growth and then everyone catches up and it's a different game. So, I got drafted at 14 and then right into I was getting pursued by agents right away. So, I realized at 14, 15 that the dream was starting to unfold. I grew up watching Kamloops Blazers games, Kelowna Rockets games, so I was Western Hockey League bound from day one. You know, my dad's a physician. He always said you can go to school when you're done playing. So I committed to being a hockey player, started training off ice at 15, and went into my journey as an elite level hockey player with Calgary Hitmen. I played 8 games as a 15-year-old that year. Was an interesting start to my junior career. I was there right when the Graham James stuff came out. So I met Graham. I was around Graham. So that was a really bizarre time when I look back on it. From there, went into my 16-year-old year, had a really successful year, but it was very challenging moving away from home. You know, going from my dad as a coach to and playing, like Sycamus, we played every second shift. We had 10 players a team. So for me, it was a challenge to not get as much ice time as I did. But it was successful. Headed into 17-year-old year, ranked quite high in the NHL central scouting rankings, and we had a great team in that year, and ended up winning the league and going to the Memorial Cup, which we lost in overtime 7-6, which was a strange game. Both starting goalies got pulled and put back in that game.
Wild.
pretty
don't know that happened very often.
No, I don't think it happens ever. I think it's the first and only time it's ever happened in the history of hockey. But I went on, got drafted to Washington Capitals, 7th overall. It was an incredible moment in my life to be in Boston there. And that was a crazy draft when the Sedins got traded to Vancouver picked up for those picks. So I look back on those times again, and it's just I was right there for that deal. So it was pretty neat. From there, just went into 2 training camps with the Capitals. An important part of this story is that all along I've been being compared to every player under the sun, starting at 11 years old. I remember a Dallas scout watched me in Cowichan and told my dad that I looked like Guy Lafleur. And then, you know, the comparisons at 15 to Paul Kariya and Joe Sakic, and then all the way up, you know, these comparisons. George McPhee of the Capitals, the Capitals GM, you know, likened me to Steve Yzerman and coming in and being a young captain. And so lots of expectation and definitely built up who I thought I was. You know, my parents were new to it, so they were right along with the hype. I was right into the hype because I was just a young brain that was in it, and my parents didn't. It was the first time they experienced it, so I didn't have much grounding. And even my agent at the time was really new into it. And you talk to him now, and he stamps out any type of hype that's around his players nowadays. So went into 2 camps with them. As a 19-year-old, I ended up staying there and making the team for the first 10 games. Ron Wilson was a coach. I played with my first game was against LA. And Ron Wilson at home, and Ron Wilson matched me against Joseph Stempel, Zygmunt Palfy, and Luke Robitaille all game.
So, nice guy.
I understand what he was trying to do. He was trying to see if I was ready to play against players like that. Did okay. I ended up -2, but they were one of the best lines in the game at the time. From there, I went back to junior for my final year. In junior and had a great year there, and got cut from the World Juniors that year, one of the last cuts, and then went into my first pro year as a 20-year-old, and that off season I got traded from Washington to Pittsburgh in a deal that saw Jäger move from Pittsburgh for the first time. So I got traded in that deal, and again went into Pittsburgh with big expectations. The papers and the chatter around the room was that I was the next young guy to come in and take over the franchise, and Ron Francis was being thrown on me as well. So again, more, you know, these high expectations. And then that started my career. Played my first year in Pittsburgh, and you know, it was a phenomenal experience. I played on the line with Mario for a few games. One of the greatest parts about that year was almost every day after practice, a group of us would play just kind of like a pickup shinny game. It would be Alexei Kovalev, Martin Straka, Robert Long, myself, Alexei Morozov, and Jan Herdina, and we play 3-on-3 pickup game almost every day. They loved it. It was for them. They were able to experiment and be creative in that moment. So that was one of my favorite times of that year. But we didn't make the playoffs, and then from there, the second year, obviously I wanted to improve as a sophomore and had full expectations I was going to be on the club, and they had other ideas for me. And that second year, they sent me down to Wilkes-Barre, which really had an impact on my ego, and the inflated ego from all these comparisons and expectations. That wasn't who I was as a player, and it would have a big impact on how I viewed success the rest of my career. So that was a start. From there, I could go on and on about stories, but that's how it all started. Yeah.
So when the bubble burst a little bit, when you hit that epiphany, you're playing on a line with Mario Lemieux, and then all of a sudden you're sent down to the minors, the ego burst. But did that, because you talked about the highs, what led to the lows? And it was kind of a roller coaster ride from that point going forward, if I'm correct.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And you know, I think to be really clear on this whole story, there was a mixture of the highs and lows of high level competition, but also I started experiencing some mental health challenges at 17. I had a trauma, a family trauma, and I won't get into the details of it because we've made peace with it, but that led to a post-traumatic stress eating disorder at 17. For about 5 years, I really had to watch how much I ate and how quickly I ate, or else it would set off a nervous reaction, which would make me vomit. So I was dealing with that all the way through as well. So there was already the beginnings of some mental health challenges along the way, and then you add in the pressure and the expectations of that environment, and so it was definitely challenging. But yeah, that moment when I got sent down, really, you know, that bar I had set for what type of player I was already that player. I hadn't done the work yet to get there. And I think, you listen to the greats, like a guy like Sidney Crosby, when he headed into league, he felt the pressure to make the team and prove himself every year. And in my mind, I was already that player, which yeah. I wasn't that player yet. So, so that bar I had set after getting sent down to the minors, it was something I would chase, that type of franchise player the rest of my career. And 4 years in Pittsburgh organization, and I was up and down with that team. I had some great years in Wilkes-Barre, the AHL. Like once I got down there, I finally, you know, got back into the team and my teammates. I made some of the greatest relationships in the game in those years in Wilkes-Barre. I had a lot of fun there with guys like Kobe Armstrong, one of my good buddies, Shane Endicott, who played a little bit of pro and is in Saskatoon now. Guys like Ryan Whitney were down there. Matt Murley, the guys on Spittin' Chiclets. So we had a lot of fun. So yeah, we had great years. We had a pretty successful team. Michelle Therrien was there, who was he was challenging, that guy. He was a phenomenal coach. I learned a lot from him. I learned a lot about accountability. I learned to teach the defensive game. I don't know if there's anyone better, but he had a really challenging way of motivating, which I would sometimes say things that were not would that stuck with me the rest of my career, really. But so I learned a lot from him, but he also had a way that was very challenging. From there, headed into my fifth year, I signed with Pittsburgh. And then right before camp, I was full on ready to go to camp, and they had just drafted Crosby. They drafted Malkin the year before. So I knew I wasn't the guy anymore, but I still had the aspiration to skate with those guys and contribute to that organization. I love Pittsburgh. I love the Penguins. I wanted to play there. But I got traded right before camp, 2 days before. And at the time, I didn't know why. But several years later, I talked to the GM, Craig Patrick, and he actually told me why. And in the phone call at the time, he said, we're going to trade you and you're going to Nashville. And that was basically it. And then I was gone. But several years later, I talked to him and he told me why. And he said they had 50 contracts. They were only allowed 50 and they had to make room for one more. And at the time before camp, I was the only guy that was of any interest to anybody. And the contract they had to make room for was Mario's contract. So off I went to Nashville. Nashville was good. I went there, a crazy moment in my career. There was three Sicamese boys in that camp, Shea Weber, Cody Franson, all in the same NHL camp. I have a picture from Shea. He dropped it off at my house when I was, I think I was 16. He was 12 or maybe I was 17. He knocked at my door and handed me a picture from his spring hockey team. And he had signed it, and he said, "To Chris, see you in the NHL, Shea Weber." And there we were in the same wow. training camp. Yeah. So it wasn't like he didn't say, "I hope to see you." He said, "I will see you in the NHL." And so that's quite a neat story. The three of us there ended up in that camp, did pretty well. Got to play with Hartnell and Radulov on a line, and we did pretty well. But got sent down, and again heard from the GM and the coach that I had all the tools physically, but there was something missing. So I constantly heard this: there's something missing, and went down to Milwaukee. Obviously, every time you get sent down, it's tough. It takes a couple weeks to get over it, but once you start to get to know your teammates and get back in the groove with enjoying them and enjoying the game. We had a great coach in Claude Noel in Milwaukee. He was one of my favorite coaches, technically sound, great people person, held you accountable, listened to your opinion, would change his opinion if he thought you were right. So a phenomenal, phenomenal coach. We had a great team, and I played really well at the AHL level there. Probably the best to date. And then got into the trade deadline that year, got traded back to Washington. So
you did a full circle.
Yeah, back to the team where it all started. And same GM, George McPhee. And went in there. George let me know that I was coming in for the rest of the season, 20 games left. So that's my impression was that that's what I was going to do. Got in there, three games in, got sent down to Hershey, and was there for a couple of games, and then got called back up for another couple of games to Washington, and then got sent back down to Hershey. But it was neat there because That was Alex Ovechkin's first year. He scored 50 there, so I got to see that that go on a little bit there, a little taste of that. But then got sent down to Hershey. Great experience in Hershey. We had a phenomenal team. Many NHLers came from that team. Brooks Light, Boyd Gordon, Thomas Fleischman, Mike Green, and some great AHL players. So we absolutely dominated the rest of the season, and we went, we swept the two first rounds of the Calder Cup Finals, and went on to a tough series against Portland in the third round, but ended up beating them. Game seven in Portland, Anaheim just finished their playoffs, and they get Ryan Getzlaf, Corey Perry, and Dustin Penner down for game seven.
Down to the team.
yeah. So it was, and we, Eric Fair ended up scoring the OT winner. And we went on to the finals against Milwaukee. So the team I got traded from. And we ended up winning the Calder Cup there. So, which was a phenomenal experience. One of the greatest times in my hockey career was winning that that championship, and I played lights out, and it was good enough to carry me into another contract with Washington. Made that team out of camp. I wasn't on a one way. I was still on a two way. Which, if anyone watching, there's a little bit of difference between what you make as a one way contract in the NHL versus a two way. There's differences in how they can treat you. So still on a two way, but I made the team. And played all year with that group, and I got to watch Alex Ovechkin perform night in, night out. And he was a great, great human being and a wonderful leader, and just loved the game. So I really appreciate my time with him. Went into the next year and was a restricted free agent. So I had a few more rights at my age. And Washington they left it right to the deadline to tell me whether they're going to give me a qualifying offer, which, for those of you watching, that means at that time you got a 10% raise on your salary. But with the new rights I had the possibility of going to arbitration, and my numbers that for that year were good numbers for the ice time I got, third line ice time. So if I would have went to arbitration, I would have got most likely a one-way deal for far more than 10%. So they waited to the deadline and let me know that they were going to go with someone else. So off to free agency I went. This is where it gets really interesting in my time in North America. So free agency, narrowed it down to a team. Columbus Blue Jackets, talked to Ken Hitchcock there on the phone, and you know, he let me know that they wanted me to come in and fill that second or third line center spot. So it sounded great, and I was excited about it, and there was some spots open there. So I went in there with that attitude to make that team, and did pretty well. But ended up being again the last cut of that team, back on waivers. And cleared waivers and went down to Syracuse. And this is where, you know, this is where Syracuse was a really, really tough time in my life. And it was the first time where I really started to pay attention to my mental health issues, because it was debilitating. It was hard for me to get to the rink at that time. I was diagnosed major depressive disorder at that time. I was on, you know, I was taking anti-anxiety pills, antidepressants, and I remember just on the way to games, I had to take anti-anxiety pills before the game, because it was just overwhelming. So a really tough time, but I kept pushing. I knew how to grind it out. I knew it was something that I'd lived with for so long that it was something I could deal with, and ended up playing well enough for the first several weeks to get called back up to Columbus, and played there for 2 months, and it was some of the best hockey I played at the NHL level. in my time. And so 2 months came up and there was a deadline for the team. I was still on a two-way contract. The team had a deadline for players in my situation at 2 months. They had to decide whether they were going to tell me to get a place for the rest of the year or they had to put me on waivers. Because I was in a hotel that time, and they decided that they were going to put me on waivers. They did that in the middle of the week. And they said if I was going to clear waivers, I would still be playing for them on Saturday. But I didn't clear. I got picked up by Vancouver. So off to Vancouver and, you know, leaving a great team, great group of guys. I was successful there. So it's tough to leave, but another opportunity at the time, Brennan Morrison was out with a serious injury. So that second line center spot was there and, went in there with the attitude of taking that position. Got to play alongside Naslin for a couple of games, which was, phenomenal. But it didn't last long. I went to, about four games and got called in to the office and Beno there. He let me know again. I wasn't a good enough skater for the team or the league, so they were going to send me down to work on my skating in the AHL, which is a contrast to what Hitch said when I left Columbus. He said that I had actually proved that I was an NHL contributor and a player. So these ups and it's really still a young mind and dealing with mental health. It was a lot of different messages and confusing messages. So went on waivers and a few days roll by and I get picked up again and I get picked up by the Washington Capitals. So the same team from the year before, same GM, talked to him and he let me know that, we should have qualified you. Welcome back. There'll be a lot of guys happy to see you. I try to get on a plane to get down there and get to the border agent. And he looks at my passport and he says, okay, well, you're going down to play hockey. I need to see your work visa. And I didn't have it because a Canadian agent ripped it out of my passport as I went up to Vancouver. So I couldn't get across the border. And I went to the hotel at the airport, got in contact with the team. They were trying to find ways for me to get across the border. They flew me to Toronto because they thought they were more lenient in Toronto. The guy in Toronto said, "Hey, do you know this is a federal offense if you're port shopping?" I'm like, "No, I did not know that." So it took me 10 days at the border. In that time, Washington put me back on waivers and ended up getting picked up by Pittsburgh. So back to where it all started. And Therrien was a coach at the time and lots of players there that I'd played with in the minors. So Crosby and Malkin, Gonchar, these guys were on fire. Fleury. A great opportunity for me to go in there. This was 2008. So that team went on a run to the Stanley Cup Finals. 5 games in to getting there after 10 days in a hotel with no ice. I had a few practices to get back into shape. Played 5 games, and then the 5th game I ended up going in a corner with big Glenn Wesley, and he came out the winner of that one. And I broke my wrist 5 games in, and that was my my chance to get in the NHL playoffs. Someone else came right in my spot and took it. So they kept me around, so I got to see and be with the team through that run, and was that close to playing for my dream in Stanley Cup playoffs. So, but didn't quite get there, and it was a bit of a journey to get there. But learned a lot. Watching those guys, being around Crosby for the short period of time, made a huge influence on me. He was an incredible human being and leader, just constant learner, positive, asking me questions about why I do things, giving me suggestions, just a And he's like 20, 22 or whatever he was. So 21, maybe even younger than that, just an incredible person. But yeah, that's my years over here. And then lots of stories from there, but I'll try to keep it a bit short.
In purpose of time, I mean, we'd love for that journey to continue all the way through right to the end when you hang up the skates. But interesting enough, I was watching the Pittsburgh game yesterday.
Yeah.
And Pittsburgh has the longest playoff record in professional sports history right now. Yeah. 15 consecutive years they've made the playoffs. Mm-hmm. A lot of people don't realize that. And you were in the team with Mario Jagr leaving, but I don't know if that started them, but it's 15 years. And then we've got Malkin and Crosby and back and forth. And then the Capitals with their great runs and played with amazing players. You've had a whack of coaches. I'll ask one last question before we get to team ability.
Yeah.
The best coach that you had, who would it be and why?
Best coach that I had.
Could be even minor hockey all the way through the pipeline because then you went on to play in Europe. So I'm just curious.
My dad was pretty good. He was back in the early 90s. He was talking about, interchanges, transitions, regroups. We learned zone defense. We would be able to determine when to 2-1-2 forecheck, when to 1-2-2 forecheck, and this was in Kiwi and Bantam. So he was pretty smart hockey guy, but he was crazy. He didn't treat the referees very well, unfortunately. Beyond that, I would say Claude Noel, Bruce Boudreau, and then Kent Johansson in Sweden. All technically sound. Claude Noel, technically sound, but just the way they treated people with respect. They listened. You could tell, but they held you accountable at the same time. It wasn't a country club. They challenged you, but they had this way with people that just got the best out of you. And Bruce was... He was phenomenal as well. The best technical coaches probably I had were Ken Hitchcock and Michelle Therrien. But those guys, they just had a way with people for me that I resonated with. Yeah. And like I said, with Claude, he listened and he would take my opinion into consideration, and if he thought it was right, he would say, "Yeah, you're right," and which was different than I was used to all the way to that period. So,
and we've seen a big evolution in recent years of that transition to transformational coaching, where that big connection piece, and they're a player's coach or an athlete coach, athlete centered, the coach, the player. It's interesting to see the path and. 20, 30 years ago, didn't hear a lot of that. Now you're starting to see that become more evident at the professional level. Unfortunately, we're starting to see that trickle down into, the minor sports, regardless of hockey. So done a big, deep dive in your hockey career. So leading into your vision, graduating from your master's program, I believe, if I recall correctly, Ireland, and your thesis, which has led to where you are seeing your baby come to fruition. We've talked about it a few times. Aimability. Let's talk about the platform and why you founded it.
Yeah, it is a labor of love for sure. I wrote it as a dissertation, business plan for it, my master's in sports management there in Northern Ireland. It came from my experience, essentially. I mean, The experience I went through, I had phenomenal support along the way. I wouldn't be here with you today if I didn't have that support and that network of people around me that helped with performance and health challenges. Eventually, I figured out that it turned out to be that I have bipolar disorder. So I've been dealing and managing bipolar disorder for probably over a decade. So it was a combination of having access to all the best people wherever I was to help. And so I wanted to harness that privilege that I had as an elite athlete and make it more accessible to everybody, all athletes. So that's the premise behind the platform, is to get high-level performance educators, coaches, mentors, the best health practitioners, and make them more accessible to everybody and more athletes, not just the elite athletes. And in particular, I think the mental performance side of things is really still reserved for the very best. We want to get it out to whoever wants it, because it's important not only for sport but for everything that we do in life.
And so the big focus is going to be helping on the whole performance piece, whether it's more on the mental side than on the physical side. Correct me if I'm wrong.
Yeah, that's definitely where I started in building that group of professionals. But the platform will have technical skill development and things like strength and conditioning, some education on injury prevention. Like, we have Dr. Jack Taunton on there giving some phenomenal talks that he's the legend, basically the founder of modern sports medicine here in Canada, giving talks on injury susceptibility and prevention, recovery. So we want to look at both the tangible side of sport and the intangible side, but definitely my time has been building that more intangible skill development side of the coin.
Cool. And as far as how it's working, because we've had conversations, I'm Charles, and it's organization based, where the members of the organizations will then get invited to the platform when they partner with you. So, like, using the example of Softball BC. So now a lot of their members are going to have access to the platform. But if you're just an individual athlete or a coach, or whatever, you can't just sign up for it.
Yeah, we there's a few different aspects to AIMability, and that's one of them is the security aspect of open networks. We want to get away from being an open network where anyone can go and sign up, and that's strictly a security measure. We know now that companies, social media companies, and I know we're on social media companies right now, but open networks are susceptible to data breaches, identity breaches. And so philosophically, my partner, Mehdi Talwardi, is a specialist in security and data storage, and philosophically believes in protecting people to the utmost. And so our system is closed. You have to be an approved organization. We want to know who's coming into our platform so that people are protected, and that it's a community, a safe community to learn, to communicate, and to get the most out of the community online, and know that you're safe and your data is safe and your information is safe. So that's why we keep it to organizations getting approved. And don't open it up to everybody that wants to get on there.
You look in recent, probably the last 12 months, all the Facebook data breach challenges. In my past life, I was working, in sales, business to business to retailers. Linens and Things, a perfect example, where their whole platform got corrupted. And, it appalls me that everywhere you go, everybody's asking for your personal information. And then people are so hey, I'll just give it to you. Well, no, like, I don't want you to have access to the back end, which is, that's why I find your platform amazing. And it will hopefully, and one, it'll protect them, but also it'll provide amazing, amazing resources. And because it's online, technically it's a global platform. So you could have interest from not just Canada, but globally. Where do you see that going?
Yeah, definitely. It's there with what's going on today. It's borderless. I spend a lot of time 2010 to 12 just doing my own research. I really enjoy watching futurists speak and speak about what's coming in the future. And there's one guy in particular I used to watch a lot of, Michio Kaku, who's a physicist at CERN in Switzerland there. And he just talks about coming technology. And I think it was about 2011, I watched him speak about education and that you'd be able to tap into anybody you wanted in the world and learn from them. And that kind of, that was part of my vision as well. And that understanding, it's borderless. And although being online is not like being in person, there's still that different connectivity, that different energy. It's pretty darn close. It's pretty darn close, and you can do a lot of great work online. And eventually our goal is to be a hybrid community of in person when we can and online, because I think that's the way social networking and community networks online are going to be going, to a hybrid model of an in person and online. And that's what we're working towards. And yeah, definitely to be global is our goal, and to have, you know, the top people providing education and services on aimability in their respective fields.
And it's just a matter of time when it's going to start to explode. I know that you've already got some pretty amazing partners, and humbly I'm becoming involved on the back end, but some other amazing people that are also involved already. Like, I have a feeling, because it's kind of mirroring what we've done over the last few years, and the tapping into, you know, US, Canada, UK, and as more people get wind of it, it'll become that global platform. And well, kudos for you having that vision. It's been what, how many years? Because I think 2017 is when you kind of came up with the idea, 4 years later.
I wrote that dissertation, finished in 2016. And so it's been 5 years. It's the vision of that dissertation has stayed intact. Obviously the details of the plan have kind of slightly shifted. Yeah. I met a wonderful mentor 2.5 years ago that took it to another level. You know, just I mentioned him, Mehdi Tawerdi. He's a phenomenal person with incredible life experience. Just an amazing person, a mentor, and I owe a lot to his help to where it's gotten to now. So yeah, we're excited. It's been a lot of help to invest in working on my mind, and I've been a mindfulness practitioner for over a decade, and also an instructor for the last 5 years. And the philosophy and mindset of mindfulness, of opportunity and growth is everything that happens. I look for the opportunity and what I can take from it. And so the ups and downs are less intense. And, you know, the determination to see it through has not wavered. So I'm excited, and I'm super happy and excited that you're enthusiastic about it. And I look forward to seeing what we can create together.
I think it's going to be a game changer. There's a lot of people that have visions, but the persistence of where you've taken it to where it's going and the people you've connected with, I think it's really going to kind of set the bar for a lot of people to follow. So I'm not seeing questions, and I think it's probably because of the glitches we had early on.
Yeah,
this is available through our two Facebook platforms and will be on our YouTube channel, and I will make sure that you get a copy of it. I really, your story, we could have literally let you go for like 4 hours. Like told the ups and downs of the coaches, the players you play with, and all these things. I was just like, wow, I didn't know you played with him, and I didn't know you played with him. I kind of knew the story, but not the whole story. And then we never even got to Europe.
No, we didn't get to Europe, which was awesome. Europe was awesome.
Yeah, that could have been another – because my brother or my best friend's brother actually was the one player that I knew went on to play, played for UBC. He started off with the Eagles, so junior A, then he went to UBC. And he went on to play professionally in Germany for like 9 years. And he's Greek, and he married a German girl, and he came back to Canada, and parents were like, what? What? Because Greeks always want to marry Greeks.
Yeah.
But yeah, he had an amazing run. He said it was the best experience. He's now an accountant. You know, it's amazing how our lives, once you hang up the cleats or the skates, whatever the case may be, and the path you chose. So glad to see that things are going in the right direction for you. And I really, really enjoyed our conversation. I'm looking forward also to everything that's going to transpire with AIMability and beyond, and see where it goes. Looking forward to it.
Awesome. Thank you, Glenn. I appreciate it. And I look forward to speaking very soon.
Yeah, as do I. So we try to keep it within time. We got all off to a little slow start, but we're wrapping up at 11. And thank you so much for doing this. I'll get you a copy of the video. We're also going to convert it to a podcast so you can share that out as well.
Great.
I'll have to do some editing on the beginning or the audio glitch. Sorry about that. No worries.
My charger came back to action here, actually. So
yeah. Well, blame it on the computer company that you don't want to be.
Yeah. I won't name them.
All right. Thanks so much, Chris.
All right. Thanks, Glenn. Okay.
Talk to you later.
Bye.